Right on. Here it goes. All right, so good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's November 28th, Wednesday. Maybe I'll turn the mic up just a little bit. So let's take a look at the schedule, which I have right here. So today's the 28th. We're going to finish up respiratory system and then probably move on to digestive system as well today. And then that just leaves urinary system and diversification system to talk about next week and also on Monday of finals week. Okay, and don't forget your final exam is not cumulative. It just covers these chapters right here, just from the last test to the end of the class. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? Okay, it indeed is so that I am going to give the practical exam on Monday for the class. So even if you have a Wednesday lab, you can take the practicum on Monday and then you don't have a practicum and a final exam on Wednesday. If that doesn't work for you, then we can arrange a practical exam on Wednesday. But if you wish to take that practicum on Monday to get it out of the way, you're welcome to take it at 9 o'clock if you're in the morning Wednesday class, and I'll figure out when it is for the afternoon class, probably about 1:30 or so, something like that, okay, just for your own information. But I certainly mentioned that in lab. Okay, so I got a couple demonstrations. Let's see. I think I want to talk about the lungs just a little bit. What is the functional little structure for exchange of gases? Okay, capillary is the blood vessel that surrounds something that I'm thinking about. Okay, air flows into this little structure. It's called an alveolus. And then around the alveolus is a network of capillaries that can undergo exchange. So oxygen enters the blood, CO2 leaves. And then also around every alveolus, don't forget, there are these proteins. What kind of proteins do we see right here? I mentioned it last time. Yeah, they're elastic proteins. So that when an alveolus expands, then it will shrink back down to its normal size when muscles relax. So exhalation under most circumstances is just passive, just by relaxing muscles. Air leaves your body. Okay, so I want to add one last thing. So here we have an alveolus. Okay, here are the capillaries around it. And here's that respiratory membrane that we use for exchange of oxygen and CO2 from air in the alveolus and blood that's in this capillary. Here we see a nice illustration of an alveolus. Here's a capillary, and the wall of an alveolus is just a simple squamous epithelium, just like the wall of the capillary, so it's very, very thin. Okay. So I see some macrophages running around inside an alveolus as part of your immune response, but there's also another kind of cell in there, the alveolar type 2 cell. And what's the job of this alveolar type 2 cell? It has something to do with water. What's one property of water that I wanted to change your opinion on last time? Yeah, water is sticky. It's not slippery. So that when an alveolus collapses and the opposite sides of the wall touch each other, if there was water inside the alveolus, then it would not be able to separate. Just like two plates or two saucers, if there's water between them, you can't separate. And I don't know if anybody believed me, so I think we're going to do just a real quick experiment. But I don't have anybody in the front row. Maybe somebody temporarily could come and sit in the front row right here. One person. Okay, extra credit. Still nobody. No, somebody's coming. Okay. So here I have, here we have two transparencies, just plastic film. And I'm going to put them together, nice and tight, like that. Okay. And then I'm going to hold both up like this. And I'm going to let go of one of them. What's going to happen to the one that I let go of? Okay, some people think it will stick, some people will fall. This is the control experiment. So I'm going to let go of it, and look what happens. Falls right away. So there's only air between the plastic. There was no glue, there was just air, so these pieces of plastic just slip right apart. But how could we glue these together based on the hypothesis that I told you about?
Water.
So you think water is going to be like glue? I thought water was slippery. Okay, so I just put some water on there like that. Okay, and we're going to put these together once again like that. Okay, and now I want you to pull on the bottom one, not the top one, but the bottom one. Pretty sticky, huh? They got stuck together. Not as impressive as I thought. I thought I could lift you off the chair. Let's try it again. Okay, that's the one I'm holding. Good demo. Now, that was really sticky that time. Really good. Okay, thank you. Okay, so water is sticky because of the surface tension. Right, so things do get glued together. These alveoli would get glued together, and then exchange could not happen. So what's the name of the compound that this alveolar type 2 cell secretes into an alveolus so that it can expand? Surfactant, right, and it acts like a detergent so that it makes the inside of the alveolus very, very slippery. All right, so that was a nice demonstration. Another demonstration. I have two alveoli right here, and an alveolus fills up with air. Okay, and I'm going to fill these up with air, and I'm going to ask you which one is a better model of an alveolus. Okay, so I'll start with this bag right here. So this is just a paper bag, nothing inside of it. Nothing inside that bag? Good. Okay, we all agree. So I'm going to inflate it, so an alveolus inflates. And I'm going to close it off so the air can't get in there, and now I'm going to let it go. What's going to happen to the shape of this bag? Is it going to collapse down where it was? Okay, so I'll open up, make sure there's a passageway right there. Okay, and look, it stays the same shape. Okay, now think of this as an alveolus. Now think of this as an alveolus. I've got to put no air in there, right? Nothing inside the balloon. Okay, put some air in there. Oh, good, it didn't break. I didn't want it to break. Oops, sorry. Okay, so here is another example of an alveolus that expanded. Okay, and then I'm going to just let go of it, and what's going to happen to this balloon? Is the air going to come out of it? Exactly right. Okay, because that demonstrated what? A property of elasticity. Right, so we could expand an alveolus, and as we let go of that pressure, what happens to it? It shrinks back down to its normal size. So there are pathologies where that elastic tissue is damaged and somebody ends up with an alveolus like this. And why is this so bad? Because you can't inhale anymore because the bag is already full. The alveolus is already filled with air. So they cannot inhale any more air. So that's kind of a fun demonstration. So let's get back to finish off this chapter. Fantastic. Okay, so know the type 1 and type 2 cells that make up an alveolus. And I think I talked about surface area. The surface area, if we were to measure the surface area for all those alveoli, all 300 million of them, it would be the size of half of a tennis court. That's the doorway for exchange. When you hear surface area, think of doorway for exchange. So I think I want to come back up over here. Mechanics of breathing, that's what I want to talk about. Okay. Mechanics of breathing. Oh, it's like, this is good. Okay, so here we have a normal lung that's not inflated, right? And this is that serous membrane that we were talking about. The visceral pleura is right on the surface of the lungs. Then we have a pleural cavity filled with serous fluid. And then we have the parietal division right up against the thoracic wall. So this is a pretty good illustration of that. Okay, so how do we get air inside our lungs? Well, in this case, when there's no air inside the lungs or very little, the diaphragm has this large curvature to it. And the lungs are this size and the thoracic cavity is relatively narrow. Right? When we contract the diaphragm, it goes inferiorly and it adds volume to the thoracic cavity. I can see a little additional volume down here below the lungs. And also there are muscles, okay, intercostal muscles that pull the rib cage out to the side and also anteriorly as well. So the rib cage expands. So it expands in this inferior direction, but it also expands laterally and anteriorly as well. So the volume gets very, very large when you use those muscles. And there's a relationship between volume as pressure. As the volume increases, the pressure decreases. Right? So as the volume gets bigger, the pressure decreases, and that shows you right here. There's a decrease in pressure. And air is a fluid, and fluid will move by a pressure difference. And it will move from high pressure to low pressure, any fluid, whether it's a liquid or a gas. And so when there's low pressure inside the thoracic cavity, air just flows into it. You kind of act like a vacuum cleaner. Okay? Air flows into the lungs. And then the lungs expand to this larger volume. Okay, but there's something else that you should know. The serous fluid, how would you characterize the serous fluid in the pleural space? Do you think it should have surfactant? Or should it be sticky like water? Okay, well, we want the lungs to expand and to follow the shape of the thoracic wall as it increases. So we would actually like to have the surface of the surface of the lung, not the inside part of the lung, but the surface of the lung stick to the thoracic wall so that when we change the size of the wall of the thorax, the lungs get pulled open as well. Okay, so serous fluid in the pleural cavity should be like water, very sticky, but fluid in an alveolus should have surfactant in it so that it can expand. All right, so now we have air inside the lungs. How are we going to get air out of the lungs? We can do this by changing the volume of the lungs. So remember, we said that they're inversely related. If the volume of the lungs goes up, the pressure goes down, which also means if the volume of the lungs decreases, then the pressure goes up the other way. So that's the last circumstance that I see right here. So under most circumstances, when we relax the diaphragm, it goes back to its original location because every muscle has elastic properties. And the intercostal muscles have elastic properties. So your thorax goes to the original shape. But what else has elastic in it? All the alveoli. Okay, so all of those elastic properties of the lung, right, when you relax, that decreases the volume inside the thorax, increasing the pressure so that air flows out. So inspiration under quiet breathing like you're doing right now is active. You need muscles to inhale, but right now you don't need any muscles to exhale. If you have normal lungs and normal muscles, the elastic properties just passively constrain your thorax and force air out of your lungs. So that's how we breathe. The other kind of breathing is what we call forced breathing. When we're active, when we're exercising, we have to hyperventilate, we have to increase our ventilation rate, and under those circumstances, we need to move a lot of air in and out of the lungs. This passive recoil of all the elastic properties inside the lung doesn't work fast enough. Under those circumstances, then we have to use some muscles to increase exhalation. Okay, like we'll contract the abdominal muscles, like the rectus abdominis and transverse abdominis. And that will force force the contents of the abdominal cavity up into the diaphragm to get it back in this superior position right here. So you contract your stomach muscles. Okay, and also there are intercostal muscles that are contracted under that circumstance. And those would be the internal intercostals. We'll pull the rib cage back down, decreasing the volume, increasing the pressure, forcing air out of the lungs. Okay, so it's really not too complicated a discussion, right? To just really appreciate how important those elastic properties are, the proteins and muscles. That's important for expiration during quiet breathing. And know something about what has to change for forced breathing or hyperventilation. You need to start using some muscles to get the air out of your lungs. Okay, any questions on that? All right, the control of respiration. All right, usually it's under involuntary control. You don't have to think about breathing under most circumstances because in the brain, and let's see what part of the brain it is. So here is the cerebrum, and I see a nice corpus callosum. Here's the brainstem, And what are these two locations in the brainstem? This one right here is the medulla, and here is the pons, and these are involved with regulating a lot of automatic functions in your body, like blood pressure, and also breathing, because we don't have to think about breathing. All right, so there are some nuclei inside the pons and the medulla that control the rate and depth of inspiration. So these are autorhythmic, sort of like your heart, okay, and it can be modified by some of these other nuclei. All right, so there's a ventral respiratory group, that's the pacemaker. Okay, so here is the ventral, here's the ventral respiratory group labeled up over here that generates the rhythm, the natural rhythm for inspiration. The dorsal respiratory group is here. It can modify the normal rhythm. It can speed up or slow down inspiration, as well as the pontine respiratory center right here. It can interact with these medullary centers, both of them, to adjust the rate and depth of inspiration. Okay, and here I see a nice diaphragm. And so then there is a nerve that goes from this respiratory center all the way to the diaphragm. And you should know what that nerve is. It's a really important nerve. Who knows what that is? I've talked about it in lab and in lecture too. And even you know what the origin of that nerve is. What is that nerve again? It is the phrenic nerve, right? Phrenic nerve exits through the neck, cervical spine, and goes all the way down to the diaphragm. Okay, so what's the origin of the phrenic nerve? I said cervical region, but you probably already know what levels of the cervical region. I told you a little kind of funny saying to help remember that. And that little saying is 3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. So that's, and so then those nerves go into a plexus and they form the phrenic nerve right here. Okay, so the phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. Oh, and it says right on your slides, between C3 and C5. That's the origin of the phrenic nerve. So these groups right here will take information from various parts of your body to see how well you're ventilating and will adjust your ventilation depending on what your body needs. And so some of the information that's really important we have on the word slide. There are chemoreceptors in your body. What's a chemoreceptor? It measures chemicals, right? So it measures chemicals in your body. And in particular, right, they measure CO2 and pH. They're located in the medulla oblongata itself. So this part of your brain is a CO2 detector and a pH detector. So that if carbon dioxide, which is a waste product of metabolism, increases in your body, what would you guess should be the correct response of your body if CO2 is building up, which is a waste product? CO2 is building up in your body. It's a waste product. You should, excrete it from your body by exhaling. So CO2 is a very powerful chemical that can do what for ventilation? I have it right here. Increases the rate and depth of breathing so that you can get rid of that excess CO2. All right, pH is a measure of acidity. And as this pH number gets smaller and smaller and smaller, it means that the solutions are getting more and more acid. So here we see, as your body is becoming more and more acid, that can also stimulate respiratory rate. And your body becomes more acid, for instance, maybe during exercise. What kind of chemical? Probably some of you might know the name of a chemical that is produced by exercise, which is an acid. It's called, lactic acid, for instance. So metabolism, normal metabolism, can produce acids as well, which increase ventilation. I don't know if we're going to see how that works, but in physiology, for sure, we see how that works. So these are the central receptors in the pons and the medulla. Okay, they're chemoreceptors. You also have some chemoreceptors in the carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta. Does anybody know where the aortic arch is? Anybody? Raise your hand. Anybody know where the aortic arch is? I think most people do. Everybody knows where it is in here, right? Well, there are chemoreceptors in the arch of the aorta, as well as the carotid sinus. Your book doesn't do a real good job of telling you where the carotid sinus is, but I did in lecture. Where's the carotid sinus? It's right where the common carotid is in your neck, and it bifurcates into the external and internal carotid artery. So right at that bifurcation is the carotid sinus. And it's real important because it has chemoreceptors in it. And these chemoreceptors can monitor oxygen. And as oxygen decreases, what do you think your ventilation rate should do? Your depth and rate of breathing automatically without you thinking about it. If oxygen decreases, that should increase because your body needs oxygen, right, to make ATP. So as oxygen decreases, that respiratory group in the pons and the medulla increase ventilation. So you breathe deeper and faster as a result of that. That's relatively insensitive. See, I only have one arrow right here for CO2. That means small changes in CO2 make big changes in ventilation. But in order for oxygen to change ventilation to that same degree, how many arrows do I have? Right there, by a decrease in oxygen. Yeah, I got lots. That's good. You don't have to give me a specific number, but lots. So the chemoreceptors for oxygen are not very sensitive. This is a weak stimulator for ventilation, but CO2 is what? A strong or powerful chemical that increases ventilation. All right, what are some other things that can affect respiration? Well, there are higher centers in the brain, like the cerebral cortex, because the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, and you can control skeletal muscle. You can cause it to contract, or you can cause it to relax and stay relaxed, and the same thing for the diaphragm. Okay, so here's the diaphragm. And when it contracts, it comes flat, and then that causes inspiration. But you could stop the motion of that diaphragm, override this respiratory center, right, and stop breathing, and you're going to run out of oxygen. And then what's going to happen to you when you run out of oxygen? You're going to pass out. Okay, you lose consciousness. And as soon as you lose consciousness, guess what happens? This automatic center in the pons and the medulla, okay, this respiratory center automatically then starts this diaphragm contracting and relaxing, contracting and relaxing again. So as soon as you pass out, you start breathing right away. All right, I know some little kids like to freak their parents out when they're angry at them by holding their breath. Okay, I see you shaking your head. So you guys were like that? Some of you were like that? Did you ever scare your parents by doing that? Did an instructor ever do that? Probably not. Okay. So higher centers can adjust the rate and depth of ventilation, right? And singers and musical instrument players learn how to control their ventilation to sing and play those instruments. Okay, the hypothalamus, and you know where the hypothalamus, right here, right above the pituitary gland, also can change the rate and depth of inspiration, okay, due to emotional stimulus. So this is just things that you are perceiving from the environment. All right, and like if I were to scare you all of a sudden, what would be one of your first responses? You would gasp. And what's that? That's just an inhalation, okay? And so that is performed by the hypothalamus right here. Okay, there are also proprioceptors. Proprioceptors, we find these are stretch receptors, tension receptors, and stretch receptors in muscles. All muscles have them. All joints have these receptors, and they can monitor when your body starts to move. And they send signals to this respiratory group to increase the rate and depth of respiration. So right now, we could do an experiment. Probably if I just have you sit in your chairs and put your feet on the floor and then start moving your hips and your knees, I wouldn't really consider that exercise, but your body is moving. Okay, you're not producing a lot of lactic acid. Just that process of moving your body will cause an increase in the rate and depth of respiration because of these proprioceptors that are in joints and skeletal muscles. Okay, and maybe that's one of the reasons why a lot of athletes, before they undergo some kind of competition, what do? They shake their arms, right? They move their hands. That's to loosen up a little bit, but that's also to get their respiratory system and their heart system ready for that initial beginning of that competition. Okay. There are other receptors, touch, pain, and temperature. Okay, if one of your friends comes up to you and jabs you really hard with a pencil, produces some pain, what are you going to do? You're probably going to go, you're going to inhale, you're going to gasp, right? Or touch. You know, if somebody surprises you, you might gasp as well. Okay, and temperature is a very powerful stimulator of the gasp reflex. And we should probably try this in lab because I can get my hands on some ice. And as you're doing your dissection today, I could put that ice cube right on the back of your neck, okay, and guess what you're going to do? No guesses? You're going to go like that. I'm sure you would. Nobody believes me. Okay, I'm going to have to do it in lab then. Okay, that's the gasp reflex brought on by cold, a cold temperature. All right, I just want to mention something about the ocean around here to kind of reinforce that. It seems you guys don't believe me, but I want to reinforce that concept a little bit. What about the ocean around here? Is it warm or is it kind of cold? Like if you go in it, it's kind of cold, right? And people wear wetsuits and stuff like that to keep body heat. Okay. And I remember one time there was this hornblower yacht. A hornblower yacht is just a big ship that kind of can motor around inside of a harbor, and it's got a big space so you can have a party in there, like a Christmas party, New Year's Eve party, a wedding party, or whatever. And it was in Marina Del Rey. A bunch of people were on it, and it caught on fire. And it couldn't make it to the dock to let all the people off. And I think it was Christmas Eve, right, a Christmas Eve party. And everybody was all dressed up in formal evening wear and probably a tux and everything. And the ship caught on fire, and they couldn't make it to the dock to let the people off. And it didn't have a lifeboat because the laws didn't require a lifeboat. So to escape the fire, guess what the people had to do? They had to jump off the boat in the middle of the night in all their fancy clothes, okay, into what kind of water? Cold water, okay, and probably guess what happened as soon as they hit the water? I'm sure everybody did that. And I was reading the newspaper account, and not a single person drowned. And I was just amazed. Because when you fall off a big boat like that and go kaplunk, where's your head usually when you go? It's probably underwater, and you get a big lung full of water, and it's really easy to drown. But I would guess what happened to the people before they were told to jump off the boat was that they were given life preservers. And that kept them floating enough to when they jumped in the water, it kept their head above the water and they were able to survive. Or if they did inhale some water, the life preserver brought them back up to the surface to where they just coughed it out of their lungs. All right, so the gasp reflex is really something you might be able to overcome that reflex with higher centers in the brain. Right, and I would guess if you ever have to jump off of a hornblower yacht right before Christmas, make sure you hold your breath, okay, when you hit that cold water, whether you have a life preserver or not. Okay, any questions on the respiratory system? Oh, one last thing. So this group right here automatically controls the rate and depth of respiration. And, of course, people can get strokes in the brain. They can get a stroke anywhere in the brain, the cerebrum, right, corpus callosum, or even in the brainstem here, the medulla or the pons. And a stroke then ends up killing that tissue that is no longer receiving blood. So these cells, these nuclei, die, and the respiratory center then can't perform its function. So under those circumstances, somebody can't breathe automatically. So every breath they take, they have to consciously go like that and then relax and they exhale. And before they pass out, what do they have to do? Think about inspiring air again. Force that diaphragm to contract. So you might be asking, well, how do these people sleep? How can they sleep? Well, because they're on a respirator then. So they hook their mouth up to a respirator that automatically pumps air in and out of their body when they're sleeping. So that's really unfortunate if you get a stroke in this region. And that pathology has a name. Anybody know what the name of that is? When every breath you take has to be a voluntary, active control of your consciousness and not automatic. What did we call that when people just fall asleep because of lesions in this area? Did I show you those sheep that just fell asleep? What do we call that when there's a leak? Because the reticular formation is in the same area. And if there's a stroke or damage to this area, somebody just might fall asleep because the reticular formation isn't working. What do we call that disease when you just fall asleep? Yeah, narcolepsy, not insomnia, but narcolepsy. I just think of insomnia, but that's not it. Okay, yeah, narcolepsy. But if those nuclei aren't damaged, but these respiratory nuclei are damaged, that's what produces a syndrome we call Odin's curse. Odin's curse is when somebody can't breathe automatically. They have to take a conscious breath every time they breathe. So I hope I never run into somebody with Odin's curse. That would be pretty hard to live with. Okay, so that's it for respiratory chapter. So that means we can go to digestive system. And I'm going to have to go find some slides for digestive system. Which is right here. I showed some of these slides already in lab. I think you're sort of familiar with digestive system. Okay, so let's look at this slide. This slide, I don't have text for you in your lecture notes, but you're kind of familiar with it already. Here is the whole digestive system, including the alimentary canal, which is the tube that food and digesting food move through, as well as some accessory structures that really don't digest or absorb nutrients, but they're important because they aid and they help the alimentary canal do its job. And some of these structures are salivary glands. You got to know where they are in lab, like the parotid gland, right, the sublingual, okay, and the submandibular gland secretes saliva into the oral cavity. And saliva has a couple of functions. It has an enzyme that can break down complex sugars, and your body can't absorb a complex sugar until it's broken down into simple sugars, and enzyme called amylase from a salivary gland can help in that digestive process. Right, and saliva also has mucus in it, which helps that bolus of food slide down through the esophagus right here into the stomach. And saliva also has some immune properties. It has, sometimes it has antibodies that work against infection. So there's a lot of functions for saliva. And, not in your lecture notes. I didn't put it in your lecture notes because I just modified that. So how much saliva, does anybody know how much saliva you secrete into your mouth every day? Okay, this is why it's kind of a fun, this digestive system is a really fun part of the class. Okay, because we talk about all these things. About 1 liter of saliva get introduced into your alimentary canal just by producing saliva. All right, so from 0.75 to 1.5 liters. That's a pretty big volume. And don't forget, the alimentary canal is really not inside your body. That's a tube that just runs through it. So anything that is in this tube right here is really not inside your body. So where does that water go? Where did it come from? It came from your body, and it got secreted into the alimentary canal. So you're losing water from your body every time you produce saliva. Okay? So I just want you to remember that. We're going to get back to that point a couple times. Okay, so that's the, and then food goes into the stomach, and that's kind of like a pouch or a bladder that holds food. It does a little bit of digestion, but not very much. Mostly it's for holding food. Most of the digestion and absorption of nutrients takes place in the small intestine. We'll cover some parts of the small intestine. And then that material moves into the large intestine right here. And the job of the large intestine is to produce feces. But what does that really mean? Well, we saw that in the oral cavity, we secrete a lot of water into the food that we eat, and that would dehydrate us, right? And the stomach secretes even more fluid into the alimentary canal, and the small intestine secretes fluid. So we would dehydrate very rapidly if we couldn't resorb all that water and put it back in the body, and that's exactly the job of the large intestine, okay? It resorbs water that the small intestine, stomach, and salivary glands put into the alimentary canal so we don't dehydrate. Okay, so that describes this slide pretty well, except here's the liver. We talked about bile in lab. Bile is produced by the liver, stored in the gallbladder. You're going to have to know the bile duct system. And then the pancreas produces digestive enzymes for lipids and proteins and sugars as well, and those get secreted into the duodenum. So The spleen is really not part of the digestive system at all. I have no idea why it's there. Okay, so we're going to talk about some of these individual pieces of the digestive tract, okay, esophagus, stomach, large and small intestine, but they share something in common, and that is the layers. They have various layers, and we want to know various layers because if there's a disease process, and there's one very common disease process in the large intestine, okay, and it's deadly if it's not caught in time, and it is colon cancer, right? And it's really, really common, easily cured if it's caught early enough, but the way that you know how to treat it, maybe you need follow-up chemotherapy, maybe not, is that you look and see where that tumor is with respect to all the layers. Right, so that's really important for diagnosing the extent, describing the extent of a tumor, and then you'll know how to treat it, and then you also know what the prognosis is. So let's look at some layers of the digestive tract. And, okay, we have this nice model in lab for you to look at. So here's the layers model. Right, and this is an example of the small intestine, and most of the elementary canal has the same overall structure. There are four main layers. And do I have that on your slide right here? See if I can get this out of the way. Four main layers. Yeah, I have it on your slide. The outer layer, I'm going to go in the opposite direction than your word slide. This is the serosa. Right, and the serosa has an epithelium on the outside because an epithelium covers the surface. It covers the elementary canal. And there's connective tissue that gives strength to the elementary canal so that it doesn't bulge and doesn't rip open. Okay, and certain times the elementary canal does bulge and rip open because that connective tissue is damaged. And even some of these muscles are damaged. For instance, sometimes the stomach produces too much acid and not enough mucus, and that acid will actually erode a hole in the stomach and put a hole through this connective tissue. Okay, and then stomach contents will end up in the peritoneal cavity. And the same thing can happen to the esophagus as well. We call that ulceration. Right, so, but usually the serosa right here prevents that from happening. All right, the next deepest layer we see are smooth muscles. They kind of just look like stretched out footballs. And how many layers of muscles do you see right here? Can you kind of see? Yeah, I see two layers. There's a longitudinal orientation and a circular orientation. So here's the longitudinal orientation that is superficial. The deeper one forms a circle like an orbicularis. And these two move digesting material through the elementary canal. And there's two ways that things will move. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But that's due to contraction of this smooth muscle that is in what we call the muscularis externa, because it's close to the outside of the tube. So you got the serosa muscularis externa with these two layers. And I also see a lot of nerves, right, in the muscularis externa. And indeed, the autonomic nervous system controls motility of your digestive processes. And that's especially the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory and causes contraction. Sympathetic, which is the fight or flight, inhibits these muscles from contracting. Okay, and there are just a huge number of neurons. And so we name all these neurons in the digestive system the myenteric nervous system. That's a whole nervous system, and there are more nerves in your digestive system than there are in your spinal cord. That's pretty interesting. Okay. The next deepest layer right here is the submucosa, and the submucosa has connective tissue, pretty much. That's about it. And in that connective tissue, there are glands, and we find also things that are very much like lymph nodes that fight infection. We call that mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. And so sometimes this tissue right here that kind of looks maybe beige to me, that has blood vessels and glands, sometimes we call this lamina propria. We call this tissue the lamina propria of the submucosa. All right, then the deepest layer, this right here, is what we call the mucosa. And you probably could have guessed that, because what would be on top of the submucosa? What's below the epidermis? Yeah, the dermis, right? So the submucosa is what? Sort of along the same reasoning, is below the mucosa. So this inner lining right here is the mucosa, and there's connective tissue in here. So again, sometimes people call this the lamina propria. It contains glands and it contains lymphatic tissue. And also, we see what? Another layer of, what does that look like where the cursor is? It looks like smooth muscle, right? So there's another layer of smooth muscle here, and that is called the muscularis mucosa, because it's not in this external layer, it's in the mucosa layer. So the muscularis mucosa, then lamina propria, and then lining. What kind of tissue lines a cavity or covers a surface? An epithelium, right? So here's another epithelium. In different parts of the alimentary canal, it takes a different form. In the mouth, you know, it's a stratified squamous epithelium. But in the digestive tract in particular, the small intestine, it's just a simple columnar epithelium for absorption, specialized for absorption and secretion of some digestive enzymes. So that is what we call the endothelium, not really an epithelium, it's an endothelium because it's lining the inside of this tube. Just like the epithelium lining a blood vessel is called endothelium. Okay, epithelium on the outside, endothelium on the inside. Oh, your book calls it an epithelium, but you could call it an endothelium. It's still, the kind of tissue is epithelium. All right, so those are the four main layers and some structures in those four layers. Okay, and I have that on your slide right here. All right, so let's talk about the job that those smooth muscles are doing. And I got to go way back to the beginning of the chapter right here. There are two ways that food will transit, move through the digestive tract. Okay, but it's only due to contraction of those smooth muscles. And the two ways of motion are what we call peristalsis, when circular muscles contract and they're coordinated. So this circular muscle contracts, and then it relaxes, and the one just distal to it contracts, relaxes, and then smooth muscle just distal to that contract. And you can see that here's a bolus of food moving along the digestive tract just in one direction, right, from mouth to anus. It doesn't go backwards ever, right? It's just antegrade movement of this bolus of food due to these circular muscles that are contracting produces what kind of motion? Peristalsis. Okay, but there's another kind of motion that can take place due to other coordination between circular muscles and longitudinal muscles, and that is what we call segmentation. Okay, and it doesn't move food in one direction, but it's a mixing motion. It mixes food together. All right, so let's take a look at this piece of the intestine. So here we have some food, and we dyed this a really light color. Here is another segment of the intestine, and we dyed a dark color so we know what region these different particles come from. This is the proximal region. Here's a distal region. That's where these food boluses come from. And they're separated from each other because the circular smooth muscle has contracted, and then all of a sudden it relaxes. Oops, it relaxes. Right? And the circular smooth muscle in the middle of that segment start to contract. And so I see that happening right here. When it contracts, that circular smooth muscle contracts, it separates this proximal segment, it separates this material into two compartments, right? Here's that superior one, here's a little inferior one, and the same thing for this lower segment, right? That circular smooth muscle contracts, it breaks that bolus into two pieces, but then it also then mixes these two half pieces together. And then it goes through that again. So sooner or later, what happens? You don't have heterogeneity. You don't have one compartment different than a neighboring compartment. Like, I don't know, what do people like to do? Asparagus and then mashed potatoes right here. Okay, what happens in the intestine? They get all mixed together because of what kind of motion? Segmentation, so that by the time segmentation works, there is, but there's no structure to that, right? The potatoes and asparagus is all mixed together because of segmentation. All right, but what kind of motion is going to move this bolus of food through the alimentary canal? Peristalsis. So those two kinds of motions have to work together. Okay, so here is the discussion on peristalsis and the two kinds of peristalsis. All right, so that takes us to the stomach. Okay, the main function of the stomach, I have it underlined and in bold. This is part of the digestive system, but you might notice that I have storing and mixing and I don't have digestion as an important function. And that's because it's not really that important of a function. It does a little bit, but not a whole lot. Most of the time, the stomach is storing food that we eat until the small intestine is ready to work on it. And then it also mixes gastric juice with the food that we eat. Okay, so it has a mixing function. And it produces something we call chyme. All right, so a mixing function is what kind of motility? Segmentation. Okay, and that's one of the most important functions of the stomach. So it has an additional layer of smooth muscle that you, I'm sure, remember from lab. Okay, because this was a quiz, I think, at one time. So it doesn't, in the muscularis externa, it just doesn't have a longitudinal and a circular, but it also has a bleak and an oblique layer as well, which aids in segmentation, aids in mixing gastric contents together so that everything is treated the same. Okay, so here is the stomach. Certainly you got to know the anatomy of the stomach. Food enters the stomach through the cardiac sphincter, right, which is right at the orifice of the esophagus. So this region right here is the cardiac region. The cardiac sphincter is pretty weak and maybe even non-existent in some people. So acid from the stomach can move back up into the esophagus and cause an ulcer inside the esophagus in some people. Right, and some people might even have to sleep sitting up or in an elevated head position to prevent that from happening. All right, so let's go over the regions of the stomach. And I want to start at the top. The top of the stomach, the most superior part, is the fundus. And you might want to make a list of this as well. Now, after I tell you what the list is, I'll tell you why. So the top is the fundus. Below that is the cardiac region. And then below that is the body of the stomach. And then even below that, and certainly distal to the body of the stomach, is the pyloric region, or pylorus. So you got fundus, cardiac body, pylorus, right here. And for some reasons, students in my class always mix up the cardiac region and the fundic region. Right? Usually on a practicum, I'll put a little arrow right here at the top of the stomach. And what should your answer be? Fundus, not cardiac region. Okay, so just be aware of that. Prevent your hand from writing cardiac region. Grab it with your left hand so it doesn't write cardiac region right here. Where is the cardiac region? It's way down over here by the esophagus. Okay? Okay. All right, some other things about the stomach. Here we see rugae, and rugae are folds in the stomach, not for absorption, but because it allows the stomach to extend itself. It can expand. So that we can eat and eat and eat, and the stomach does what? It stores that food that we've eaten by expanding. And I've heard, I've not seen this in a scientific article, but I have heard that the stomach can actually expand or and extend all the way down to the urinary bladder without perforating. I know, that sounds amazing, but that can happen. Maybe somebody did that on Thursday of last week. Probably not very comfortable when that happens. Okay, so you have a lesser curvature, you got a greater curvature. Here is another sphincter that regulates the entrance to the small intestine. The proximal segment of the small intestine is the duodenum, and this pyloric sphincter is normally closed. So it's rare for the stomach, when it's churning away, to squirt chyme into the small intestine. But when the small intestine empties itself, then it tells the pyloric sphincter to relax and it receives some more material for digestion and absorption. And that's usually a very powerful sphincter, but it could fail on somebody and you can get an ulcer in the small intestine as well if too much stomach acid is being produced. Okay, what else is on our word slide regarding the stomach? Some interesting things. The stomach itself secretes material into the lumen, and we call that gastric juice. Gastric juice has a couple components to it. One is hydrochloric acid. Oh, and I don't have acid right there. I should have just said it has hydrochloric and or HCl. And HCl is an acid, right? And acids are very damaging to biochemical molecules. So that acid will help in digestion. The stomach also secretes one enzyme called pepsin, and it does an initial digestion of proteins. It can't break proteins down completely, but it does an initial digestion of proteins if there's hydrochloric acid available. Okay? But that's really the only digestive process of the stomach. The stomach doesn't really have much in the way of absorption, but it does absorb something. It absorbs vitamin B12, okay? Because the stomach secretes intrinsic factor. So this is a compound that can absorb vitamin B12 from the chyme that's in the stomach and transport it in the body. And does anybody, did we ever talk about vitamin B12 in here? No, I don't think we did. Vitamin B12, let's see if I can remember. Yeah, sometimes it's called cobalamin. It has a little, I don't test you on this, unless it's a question at the end of the chapter or the online question. But, you know, hemoglobin has a little iron molecule in it to do its job. That's a little piece of metal. And cobalamin has a little piece of metal, but it's cobalt. And so you do need these vitamins in your diet because you can't possibly make these elements. You can't make iron, you can't make cobalt, and you can't make vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is important for mitosis. And so you can't replace cells that are old and damaged without proper vitamin B12 in your diet. Like what kind of tissue replaces itself very quickly? Blood tissue, that's right. Every 2 weeks or every 2 seconds you produce, you know, every second, 2 million to 3 million red blood cells are produced. So somebody can be anemic if they don't have the proper levels of vitamin B12 in their diet. Okay, and chyme is what? The mixture of food with gastric juice. Okay, so you might be asking, well, if the stomach secretes pepsin, which can digest proteins, and hydrochloric acid, which could by itself cause an ulcer, eat a hole right through the stomach, how does the stomach protect itself from autodigestion? Because there are cells in the epithelium that can secrete mucus onto the surface, right, onto the surface of the stomach. And what were those little unicellular glands called that secrete mucus? Yeah, goblet cells. I'm sure I have a picture in here someplace. I'll try to find a picture. So when a goblet cell secretes mucus, mucus is especially hard to digest. Doesn't seem like it when it's running out of your nose, but it is. Right? So there's a layer of mucus that prevents autodigestion of the stomach. So that's an important function of mucus. There are other cells. Oh, it says right here, goblet cells. So that wasn't too difficult to answer that question. There are parietal cells also in the stomach that secrete hydrochloric acid and that intrinsic factor. So you should know where HCl comes from. That's a parietal cell. Another kind of cell is a chief cell. A chief cell secretes pepsinogen and gastric lipase. These are enzymes. Can anybody tell me what the substrate for lipase is? What lipase is an enzyme, and I know it's an enzyme because I see an ASE at the end of the word. So if you see an ASE or an ACE at the end of a word, that's probably an indication, a really good indication, that it's an enzyme. It's performing some kind of chemical job inside your body. It's going to change something to something else. So what is lipase changing? It's changing, it's breaking something down. It's breaking down lipids, yeah. And so that's a nice modern nomenclature that's used. There are some enzymes that are really old, were studied long time ago, where that isn't followed, but usually the substrate is used in the name of the enzyme. So a lipase will break down lipids, okay, in the stomach. The chief cells also secrete pepsinogen, okay, and pepsinogen is a precursor to pepsin. And I know it's a precursor because, again, I look at the end of the word, okay, and so I think I talked about pepsin up above, but at the end of pepsin we have, what word do we have at the end of pepsin here? Ogen, okay, and just like we had ASE on lipase, here we have ogen. Anytime you see a word with an ogen as a suffix, that means that it's inactive, okay, but it can be converted into an active form very easily, right? So pepsinogen is produced in the wall of the stomach right here, and if it were produced in an active form, what would pepsin do? it would digest the stomach. But since it's produced in a form that we call pepsinogen that we know is inactive, then pepsinogen cannot digest the stomach down. And when pepsinogen enters the lumen of the stomach, right, then it is churned by segmentation along with hydrochloric acid, and the hydrochloric acid then breaks off a part of that molecule so that it becomes active. So hydrochloric acid is necessary to convert pepsinogen into pepsin, which can start to digest things that are inside the lumen of the stomach. But that protects the stomach. What's another thing that protects the stomach? There's a coating on the inside of the stomach. Mucus. Right. Mucus. Okay, so all of these cells that are secreting gastric juice is composed of all of those things. Okay, all those cells secrete gastric juice, and it's to a volume of about 1.5 liters every single day. All right, so if you think of saliva and gastric juice together, how much fluid has your body lost? Because that fluid that goes into the stomach is not inside your body. It's really outside your body. It came from inside, and now is outside your body. Yeah, 3 liters. What does 3 liters look like? Well, you know what a 2-liter bottle looks like. Well, it's 1.5 of those. So you can imagine if you were to lose that much fluid every day, you would become dehydrated just from considering saliva and gastric juice. So you should be concerned about that fluid that's put into the alimentary canal. We're going to keep talking about it because we have more segments of the digestive tract to talk about. Other kinds of cells are stem cells, okay, that renew the gastric epithelium every 3 to 6 days. So even though pepsinogen is not activated until it gets into the stomach, and even though there's a mucus lining on that epithelium that protects it from hydrochloric acid and digestion, you still can imagine that that's a pretty rough environment to be living in next to all that hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. So these cells and that epithelium are replaced every 3 to 5 days. And for those cells to work, they need vitamin B12 as well for mitosis. All right, so this is a highly metabolic region, right, because those cells are being replaced. So that's two areas now. You know, in erythropoietic tissue, tissue that makes red blood cells like red bone marrow, undergo mitosis very rapidly, as well as these cells that line the digestive tract. Let's see if I can pull up another fun slide. Okay, so here is just a cross-section of the wall of the stomach. We see the muscularis, well, the serosa, which is most superficial, the muscularis externa, and you can see here it's been modified to have 3 layers, longitudinal, circular, and here's that oblique layer. Then here's the submucosa, and then here is the mucosa with lamina propria, and then there are big indentations from the surface of the stomach, okay, into the lamina propria of the mucosa layer, and these are glands that secrete everything into the stomach that we just talked about, intrinsic factors. So there are parietal cells and chief cells, and then there are stem cells down over here that proliferate by mitosis to replace the cells that die on the surface of the stomach. So sometimes we call this a gastric pit. Okay, so here's a gastric pit, and then down below that is a gastric gland, which contains chief cells and parietal cells, and then even some goblet cells for mucus. All right, so all of those cells are in there. All right, so that takes us to, take a look at this. Oh, this just shows how pepsinogen is converted to pepsin with hydrochloric acid. And the enzyme that does that, so hydrochloric acid promotes that reaction, but it's pepsin itself that converts pepsinogen into pepsin in the presence of hydrochloric acid. All right, let's look at the small intestine. I think that's the next topic. Small intestine. Okay, what's the function of the small intestine? It says right there on that slide. Most important function of the small intestine is function. There's really students here. Digestion and absorption of nutrients. Okay, and that's really the first part of the alimentary canal that's responsible for that. Okay, there are intestinal glands that secrete about almost, again, 2 liters of fluid into the small intestine. So what are we up to? Let's just say this is 2 liters, but that's a little big. Well, let's just say it's 2 liters. Yeah, so now we have 1.5 liters of saliva in the alimentary canal, and 1 liter from the stomach. That's 2.5, right? And then here is another 2, so that's 4.5, almost 5 liters of fluid, right? That's like 2.5 of those big Coke bottles that you would lose if you did not resorb it and put it back in your body, okay? But the small intestine is not responsible for that. It's for absorbing nutrients, the breakdown products of complex sugars and proteins and complex lipids. Okay, so things have to move from the lumen of the stomach to the blood. And so what do you need in order for you to move from one area of the body to another? What do we call that process? We call that, yeah, diffusion is, for instance, it's a good physics way of talking about it, but I'm thinking more in terms of what happens in a capillary. What's a capillary specialized for? And you could say diffusion as its basic process, but I think about it more generally as, I forgot, what? Exchange, right. And what do you need to enhance exchange? Yeah, and what is a surface area? It's just a doorway. We went over that last time, right? So the doorway has to be big for exchange to take place. All right, so in order for you to absorb nutrients in the small intestine, the surface area should be huge, probably even bigger than the surface area for your lungs. And don't forget, your lungs is what kind of surface area? Half a tennis court. That's huge. But it's even more so for the small intestine. Okay, let's look at and see why that is so. That is so because the small intestine, here's the small intestine. I can see that, of course, it's bent. Right, so we can take a long tube and kind of bend it up, convolute it so it fits into a smaller space. All right, but there's something else that happens. Look, the inside of the small intestine is also folded up. Even on this straight segment of the small intestine, there are folds inside the small intestine which increase the surface area, right? Because we could take the small intestine and flatten out all of those folds by pulling on either end, and what would happen to the length of the tube? It would get longer, which means that the doorway is getting bigger as well. Okay, so these things we call plicae circularis, or sometimes circular folds, because they just kind of wrap around. I can see them right up over here. They just encircle the digestive system, especially in the small intestine, making it a lot longer than how it appears if you look at it with just your naked eye. But you know what? I see some more folds on the surface of these plicae circularis right here. These are what we call villi, okay? And so these increase the surface area of the small intestine as well, because we could grab the small intestine right here, get a little pinch of small intestine, and what would we have to do to flatten out all those villi? We'd have to pull on it, and what would happen to that length of small intestine? Would it stay the same length or get smaller or longer? It would get longer. The surface area would increase. All right, so the first two things that we talked about are the circular folds increase the surface area for absorption. The villi here increase the surface area for absorption, and there's even some other things. Because on the surface of these cells, there's microvilli. There's folds of the cell membrane that reach up into the lumen of the digestive tract that aid in absorption. Okay? And there's something else that's functional that I'll just say in passing, is that up in each of these plicae circularis, and indeed each of these villi right here have some smooth muscle. So these things are not just sitting there waiting for something to come by. What are they doing? They're wiggling around and they're mixing things up, okay? And so that aids in absorption as well. Just like if you have a pot and you put it on a burner, what do you do to get it hot? You stir it up. And if you stir it up, it gets hot faster, because that makes the bottom of the pan actually bigger in a physical sense if you stir it up. So that helps with heat transfer. Okay, that, and so these things are like doing that as well. The villi. Okay, so here is a villus, and you can see this now at the cellular level, so you certainly can't see these cells with your naked eye. And it's really hard to see a villus. Maybe we'll take some intestine from our fetal pigs and look at it underneath a microscope. But if you open up the small intestine, you'll see that it has a really velvety appearance. It's really hard to see the villi right here, but you know that it's just not a flat surface when you look at it. So it's right at the edge of something that you can see with your naked eye. Okay, but underneath a dissecting microscope, for sure you can see it. So these are absorptive cells, and you can see this is just a nice simple columnar epithelium. And if we look at the apical surface of these cells, this is what we find right here. We call that a brush border made of microvilli. And what do all of these folds in the plasma membrane do? Because you could take this cell, pinch it here in your other hand, and do what? Flatten out all of those microvilli, and then what would happen to the length of that cell? Would it stay the same length? Would it get longer or shorter? It would get longer. And that would make the doorway for exchange even bigger. So there are three important things that increase the surface area for absorption within the small intestine. And indeed, the small intestine is specialized for exchange. First, at a microscopic level, there are microvilli that increase the doorway. The second thing, there are folds, right, in the surface of the intestines, and we call those villi. That's number two. And then number three, what's the third thing? We talked about that first. Is the circular folds, or plicae circularis, which means circular folds. So those three things increase the surface area, or the doorway for exchange. All right, so I'm going to look at the word slide. When we speak of surface area scientifically, which is what? The width of something times the height of something. We could measure it with a ruler and then calculate what the surface area is. But what should you be thinking in everyday language? What should we call that structure? Surface area is a structure, but what in everyday language would I like you to think? A doorway. Yeah, it's a doorway. And what's a doorway specialized for? Exchange, so that you can move in and out of a room, for instance. All right, so you could calculate the surface area. And so what structural characteristics increase the surface area of the small intestine, which make that doorway bigger? The plicae circularis, the villi, right, and the microvilli. If we were to stretch all of those things out and then flatten it on a table, we could actually measure what the surface area is. All right, so if we were just to take a small intestine out, put it on the table, and then cut it and lay it flat on the table, it would have a surface area of about 3.5 square feet. Not very big. But if we were to straighten out all the plicae circularis, straighten out all of the villi, make it even longer, and then straighten out all the microvilli, and then put it down and measure what the length times the width is, okay, the folding that we mentioned right here would increase the surface area to 2,200 square feet, or 47 feet by 47 feet. I don't know what that's like compared to a tennis court, but I should kind of calculate that. That's 240 square meters. Another way of thinking of it is the floor area of an average two-level house. So that's the doorway for exchange that's in your small intestine that allows you to absorb nutrients. So it's not just by magic that it happens. It's very efficient because the surface area in the small intestine for exchange is what? It's humongous. Yeah, it's big because of all of those folds. Okay, the sign-in sheet is going around, and next time we're going to start with, oh, we got to finish up small intestine by talking about some intestinal glands. Yeah. Doorway. Surface area is an area for exchange. And you could measure it just like you can measure the surface area of a doorway.